Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. I am your host, Dan Sampson, and I'm joined today by NAHU Government Affairs staff members Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman. This week's Healthcare Happy Hour includes a mix of policy and politics as we look at major healthcare legislation that is moving through Congress and a roundup of the primary elections and what we can extrapolate from them ahead of the general elections in November. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. I'd like to welcome our panelists for this week's Healthcare Happy Hour, NAHU's Vice President of Government Affairs, Marcy Buckner, and Vice President of Congressional Affairs, Chris Hartman. The big whoop of the week for the Washington Update podcast is that the Right to Try legislation is now expected to be signed into law by President Trump after the House passed their bill by a vote of 250 to 169 on Tuesday, following the Senate's passage back in August. Chris, what can you tell us about what this legislation does, and does its passage signal anything for other healthcare legislation?
Thanks, Dan. The Right to Try legislation has passed and is headed on its way to President's desk. This is all about drugs that are out there for possible cures. We're talking about things that are more in the experimental stage, the drug trial stage, and people wanting to be able to try the drugs that haven't been proven to work or not, because they are usually desperate at this point. They want an opportunity to find a cure to their disease, even if there's not an FDA-approved drug. There's a huge emotional component to this issue. I think people want very badly to find a solution to their healthcare problems. And to get into a drug trial can be very burdensome, time-consuming. And when you're in these drug trials, you have to remember there's the group who gets the drug, and then there's the group who gets the placebo. So if you're in one of these drug trials where you're getting these, you might not even be getting the drug that they're testing out. So this is legislation that allows people to get to that drug. But I would hesitate a little bit with this, and Right to Try, I think, is a strong title for what the bill actually does. I would almost describe it as a right to ask a pharmaceutical company to try this drug. There are still some safeguards in here to not disrupt the actual trials that are going on. Because while we want people to have access to these sorts of drugs, we can't disrupt the actual ability to test if these drugs work or not. We wouldn't want to just put drugs onto the market and not do any of the testing phase to see if these drugs are actually cures for anyone.
I like that analogy that it's more of a right to ask. And there are still some requirements put in place. This isn't a free-for-all for folks to request from the pharmaceutical companies to be able to try some of these drugs that haven't gone through the FDA approval, but it does change the way that this happens. So currently, there are two options for patients that are seeking experimental medications. One is enrolling in one of those clinical trials, like you mentioned, or the other is participating in what is currently the FDA's expanded access program. And the agency has said that it approves almost everyone that requests to go into the program under the way that it's currently structured. With these new changes, the FDA is largely left out of those decisions. And although, like I said, folks still need to apply and prove that they have a life-threatening illness, that they've exhausted all other available treatment options, and then they're able to go into these trial treatments, the drug still has to have passed through phase one of trials and be within an active development within the FDA approval program. So there are still requirements. But like you said, there are some safeguards and some cautions going along with this. I know Frank Pallone from New Jersey was on the floor mentioning that he's very concerned about consumer protections and what types of clinics may open up under this new right to try provision. And others have said they're worried about snake oil salesmen and things like that. So I think just as we caution about many other things in the healthcare industry, needing to have parameters around them for consumer protections, this is another area that needs those parameters just as much. And it's not just some of these politicians that are speaking out about this. There have also been some other groups, over 100 patient advocacy and consumer groups, including the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, Friends of Cancer Research, and the National Organization for Rare Disorders, that opposed the bill as well because they were concerned about those safeguards coming too far down, although they are, like you mentioned, very much in favor of trying to get medicine and treatment into the hands of those that really need it, that are critically ill.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do anything that people may start to try these drugs before trying all of the other medication that has been tested first. And so I do think there's a tendency for a person to hear about something new, read about something, and feel that's the solution to the problem versus trying drugs that have been tested out there. So I think concern about these new clinics, other sorts of ways that might bypass the existing drugs that are out there, is a valid concern that a lot of these consumer groups have out there. I think it's also a valid concern that will this delay any of these drugs actually getting through the clinical trials and to market in the end. I think some of the companies have concerns that this right to try will slow down the actual process of testing these drugs and getting them to market. And so we could be delaying possibly helping more people through this process. So it is a tricky issue. I think it passed and passes easily because it's an emotional issue. Mm-hmm. I think, Dan, you asked earlier, what does this legislation signal about healthcare legislation? I think it reminds everybody that healthcare is truly an emotional, personal question. And so I think the reason this particular healthcare issue has passed when so many other healthcare issues are stuck is because we're talking about something that is so emotional, so personal, wrapped up that people want their individual rights to try anything to save their lives.
And I think to your point about the possibility that this could hinder prescription drugs getting to the market or these drugs to be approved and to enter into the market, it's not just a factor of availability to consumers. It could also affect choice and competition in the market when we're looking at these pharmaceuticals, which of course is something that this administration has been looking at on a broad range in different areas of healthcare, but hindering that choice and competition in the pharmaceutical drug industry is something that we talked about last week with the president's drug plan. And then just one other point on this that I'd like to include. The FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, was in opposition of this bill, but since it has passed, but prior to that saying that he believes that the best decisions for folks facing terminal illnesses are those made by the patients with the support and guidance of their treating physicians. But he was very hesitant about this bill. One possibility, because it could undermine his agency's authority. Yeah. So I'm not going to say he's not biased.
Anything taking away power there is always a little skeptical in Washington.
But he has come around and says he stands at the ready to implement the law in a way that achieves Congress's intent to promote access and protect patients and to build on the FDA's longstanding commitment to these important goals. So again, getting back to promoting access and protecting patients, looking at choice and competition.
Congressional leadership has indicated that they plan to advance their opioid response legislation during the week of June 11th after they come back from their Memorial Day recess. This may be the last major healthcare legislative vehicle this year. Are there any hopes for market stability measures to be attached?
We expect to see opioid pieces of legislation being taken up in the coming weeks after Memorial Day. I think it is unlikely that market stability legislation would be attached because I actually don't think you're going to see one opioid bill. I think you're more likely to see many dozens of opioid bills get voted on in Congress that all do very small, specific things around the opioid epidemic in this country. And so it doesn't necessarily open up an opportunity to attach market stability legislation. I also think the current dispute between Alexander and Murray on the Senate side and their work to build market stability legislation, and their disagreements about being at the table and negotiating properly also means it's unlikely to get attached in the Senate, and market stability is unlikely to be passed in the next coming weeks or month. I think we are likely to see market stability legislation. It's probably at this point a little more likely post-election day than before election day.
And on the House side, you're right, they are looking at a large set of bills. They are likely to look at about 60 bills that have been introduced in the House on opioids when they get back from Memorial Day weekend. Earlier this week in the Senate, Senator Mark Warner unveiled a set of bills looking to increase access to telemedicine-based treatment for substance abuse disorders. But this is a set of bills and a number of others in the Senate that have been introduced on this issue. So I think they're going to have a hard enough time narrowing down what bills that have been introduced on opioids that they can actually include in an opioid package without even going down the road further to try to attach anything on market stability. And then kind of looking into what we saw on the Senate for Warner, looking at other ways of reimbursement for telehealth treatment from Medicare, how Medicaid funds can be used for virtual substance abuse treatment. I think this is a good kind of tipping of the hat to the telemedicine industry and telehealth. Remember, this isn't just Skype sessions and things like that. It can also be things where technology is used to monitor a patient to make sure that they haven't been exposing themselves to any of these substances, just keeping vitals on a patient that are sent to the physician. A number of different things are included in telemedicine. It's just not just Skyping or things like that that a lot of people go to think about when we say that word. But I know there's been interest in expanding coverage for telehealth resources in other markets. So if we're seeing some interest in doing that here, it's a good indication that we could see that later down the road with other types of plans.
Several conservative activist groups released their principles for health insurance reform, urging Congress to try once again to repeal and replace the ACA, arguing that the attempts last summer were modest and did little more than to amend the ACA. Is there any chance Mitch McConnell takes a look at this proposal, or is this simply an attempt to energize Republican voters for the November elections?
No, we don't really see Mitch McConnell taking up a full repeal in the Senate throughout the rest of the year or possibly in the years to come. This proposal is put together by Freedom Works, the Club for Growth, the Conservative Partnership Institute, and the Senate Conservatives Fund to try to do a full repeal of the ACA or Obamacare. And we really don't see Mitch McConnell putting this to the floor at all in the Senate. As they're ramping towards the November elections, there are some that want to get another vote on the books on this to say that they have voted for a full repeal. But with the timing, and as we just mentioned, trying to get opioid abuse legislation through, the fact that a stabilization effort probably won't be attached to that, and the need for stabilization, I think, outweighs the need for a repeal and the difficulties that would come with that, I think it's very hard for anyone other than those that are a part of some of those groups that I mentioned to want to try to vote to get this passed. If you'll remember in 2017 during our Capitol conference, for those of you who are with us in February of last year, we talked a lot about a focus on market stability and not on a full repeal. Of course, we had just had President Trump sworn into office. We had had a new Congress sworn in, and there was a focus on the possibility that there could be a full repeal because the Republicans were in the majority in the House and Senate and, of course, had the seat at the White House. But our focus at NEHU was on market stability because with a full repeal, there are a lot of unintended consequences that could happen with that from just kind of pulling the rug out from underneath everyone. And we want to make sure that we're putting in place provisions that will stabilize the market without creating any type of death spirals or unintended consequences that could wreck the market while under the guise of trying to do something good.
Yeah, so this plan is similar to the Graham-Cassidy plan that was presented that takes the funds, the tax credits, the Medicaid expansion, all of those sorts of funds, takes them and gives those funds to the states. This particular version of it has a few variations from the earlier version. It does create for 2 years a reinsurance proposal and for 2 years cost sharing reduction funding. So I think that's where they would argue that there is market stability pieces. in here. It also creates a lot more HSA funds. It really expands the amount of HSAs people can use, health savings account. Particularly when I say expand, it expands them for that cap, how much money an individual can put into their HSA. So it allows people to be able to use their money much more for their health insurance. So that's kind of how it varies a little bit from the earlier Graham-Cassidy proposal. But does this pass? What really brings anyone new on board than it was before? The Senate is one less Republican than it had before. Why would you take up this particular proposal now? Last week, we met with former Senator Rick Santorum, who's really pushing this piece of legislation. And his argument for why the House and the Senate will take up this proposal in the coming weeks is because the rates are coming out from each of the carriers state by state, and they're showing double-digit increases. And those double-digit increases will provide the momentum for deciding that this repeal and replace effort needs to come back and start over again, and we need to pass this, taking all those funds and giving to the states and letting the states figure out health care and repealing all of the ACA that comes along. So he believes as each of these states, and we've already seen Virginia and Maryland come out, as we see more come out with double-digit increases, that will create the momentum behind this. I'm a little skeptical. I was hoping that maybe the rate increases would be the momentum to pass market stability legislation around reinsurance. We saw, actually, though, as the first rate started to come out, it didn't build momentum for that. It instead built momentum for finger-pointing, for blaming each side. The Republicans blame the rate increases on Obamacare and Obamacare being in place. The Democrats blame the rate increases on the zeroing out of the individual mandate for the year 2019. And so I think every time one of these rate increases come out, everybody's just going to have their press release prepared. It'll be kind of a cut and paste situation where it's the same quote and the same lines. And that is unfortunately how I think we'll go through rate season.
Looking ahead to the November elections, we should also take a moment to look back at the primaries that have been held recently, including those who were held in 4 states on Tuesday. What are some of the major takeaways from these results and how they might predict the results in November?
Yeah, so the last several Tuesdays now, we've had several primaries going on this past Tuesday in states like Kentucky and Texas and Georgia. I think in the Democratic Party, what you're seeing come through a lot of the primaries is particularly a lot of women. I think you're seeing the most amount of women running for office in history. Also, particularly winning those primaries are a lot of veterans. There's a lot of them have a strong military record, and I think you're seeing a record amount of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans running in the Democratic primary and often winning those primaries. I think it's kind of a mixed message on which direction the party's going. We've seen some cases in places like Omaha, Nebraska, that the most progressive candidate has won, somebody who's been advocating for single payer, for larger government intervention in the economy. But then you've seen some places in yesterday's election where the more pro-business pragmatic candidate has made it through the primary in Texas, and really the candidate who was the darling of the progressives got rejected. So I think it's going to take a while longer on the Democratic side of the aisle to see through this election season if it's been a sort of a victory of the Bernie Sanders swing of the side of the party, or is it more of a pragmatic result for a lot of these elections. On the Republican side of the aisle, I think you're seeing in the House a lot of very competitive primaries for these open House seats, particularly in areas that aren't really going to be very competitive in the general election. They're areas that whoever gets through this primary pretty much is assured winning in November. There are so fewer seats that are really competitive nowadays. And so even with the record retirements that you're seeing in the House of Representatives, you're seeing probably about 75% of those aren't really going to be competitive in November. So you have a lot of Republicans trying to be the most pro-Trump and saying the other person is not pro-Trump enough, that I will back the president 100% of the time. And they're the ones who I think are starting to emerge through a lot of these primaries that we've seen in the last couple of weeks.
And I think with that point, with those that are trying to out-Trump each other, and then on the far left side with those that were with Our Revolution, with the Bernie Sanders movement and others, we're starting to see how being that partisan is hurting some folks in the primaries and how that message is falling a little flat. Of the folks that were part of the Bernie Sanders movement that were running in this past primary for Georgia, Texas, Kentucky, and Arkansas, we didn't see any of them winning their primaries. And then on the other side, where normally during a midterm election, you have the president out doing campaign speeches and visiting and trying to support others that are running in these primaries, we have a president who's going out and saying,
your vote in 2018 is every bit as important as your vote in 2016. Although I'm not sure I really believe that, but you know. I don't know who the hell wrote that line. I'm not sure. But it's still important, remember that.
Well, the 2018 midterm elections are important, but they're not as important as the 2016 election when I won. And that's a very difficult stance to have when you're trying to get your party motivated to come out and support you instead of motivating the other side to come out and vote against you. So we all know historically that during midterm elections that the president's party usually loses seats in the House and the Senate, so that won't be a particular surprise. But I think the twist here is really that messaging that the Republicans are having trouble trying to get President Trump to stay on message to get out the vote for the midterm elections.
Yeah, I thought President Trump's quote this week is a conundrum that he's stuck in of trying to motivate people in these midterm elections, but not wanting to stake the entire results of the election on his reputation. And so I think that you're going to continue to see President Trump actively involved in these midterms, but probably very strategic in the type of states he goes to. We've talked a lot about the House races here, but I think as we go into the Senate races, this is where I think President Trump could have a lot of positive impact for the Republicans in states that he won by double-digit margins in West Virginia and North Dakota and others. And that's where you're likely to see him as we get closer to November. You're not hearing about those states too much in the primaries, partly because for almost all of the primaries among Senate Democrats, they've eliminated a primary ahead of time. The incumbents did not get any challengers. And even in states like Arizona, Nevada, and Tennessee, the Democrats tried to clear the field ahead of time for their candidates. So we're talking a lot about these competitive primaries. We're really talking mostly about House races and then a couple of governor's races.
House Speaker Paul Ryan announced several weeks ago that he would retire at the end of the current term and not seek re-election, but would remain as Speaker until then. But new developments this week suggest many within his party want to repeal and replace him with a new Speaker in the interim. Is there any truth to these rumors? And if true, how could they impact both the elections and the legislative process for the remainder of the year?
So a few weeks ago, we talked about Paul Ryan's announcement to decide that he was not running for re-election and that he was going to be remaining on as Speaker. And I believe I mentioned that I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't finish the year. And so this is not a shock that there are these rumors floating about that he may step down over a number of different things, different issues that he's having trouble getting through the House. I know some members of Congress have said, yeah, he can call me to try to get my support on a bill, but really, what's the point? Why should I get on a bill for him if I know he's leaving? So there are some waning attitudes on his importance and his influence in the House right now. But on the other hand, McCarthy, who has been kind of deigned the next in line if the Republicans maintain a majority in the House or if Speaker Ryan steps down early, McCarthy has been saying that he has no plans to take over publicly. He's saying he has no plans to take over Ryan's speakership, but we do hear in private he is starting to put together his campaigning and starting to kind of lobby for that position.
Yeah, we've seen some articles this week where the head of OMB, Mick Mulvaney, former House member, that he was plotting with others to put McCarthy in power now. And last week, what we saw that I think also added to this momentum is the House put the farm bill on the floor for passage, and it failed. It went down to defeat with no Democrats voting for it, but the Republicans were unable to put their own members up. And so when Marcy was talking about taking a phone call from Paul Ryan and his asking for people to vote for the bill, I do think it's hard once people know you're not going to be here next year to really wield real power to arm twist to get people to do something they don't want to do. A lot of people, when they take a phone call from the speaker about an upcoming vote, maybe a vote they don't really want to take, maybe they don't really like the legislation, they don't think it would be good for their reelection, they're willing to do it for a speaker who's going to be here next year, who's going to determine what committees they sit on, who's going to determine things like how much the congressional campaign committees will be backing them, who can really have a large impact on their future. But if you know that Paul Ryan isn't going to be here next year, other than politely take his phone call, there's not a whole lot of reason to actually follow through or do whatever he's asking for. So I think the idea would be to bring McCarthy in now, knowing he will be here next year, would create a lot of more power around one person. I also think Mick Mulvaney has another political reason for wanting to cause a speaker election right now. So after the Republican conference has their own vote on who their nominee should be, presumably McCarthy, but possibly a more conservative member like Jim Jordan, you would have the overall election for speaker. And the Democrats would be then forced to put Nancy Pelosi back in the spotlight. And we all know that Nancy Pelosi is not popular amongst large swaths of the American public. And it puts a lot of Democrats in the awkward position of shortly before an election, voting to back her as speaker or not. So I think there's also some politics around here of trying to really highlight Nancy Pelosi, of trying to put Democrats in the awkward position of having to back her, and reminding the American public that Nancy Pelosi is there, which I, you know, according to a lot of polling out there, really helps the Republican Party.
And I think I read somewhere looking specifically at that strategy of trying to force a vote, to force these Democrats to have to vote for Nancy Pelosi. So then when they are campaigning, because there are a large number of campaign ads across the country, not just in California where Nancy Pelosi is from, that will make the connection between the candidate and Pelosi where they can to try to put the possible Democrat candidate in a negative light. But the statistics here show that the majority of Democrats in the House have already logged a vote for Nancy Pelosi as speaker. So forcing this vote would only force a vote closer to the election, but it wouldn't change the fact for many of the Democratic candidates that they've already gone on record voting for Nancy Pelosi. So there are some differing views on exactly how forcing this vote could impact them and whether it's as impactful as they think, given that these statistics already exist. But then again, looking at whether these votes happen closer to the election, if that creates more emotion on the part of the voters, if their candidate is closely tied to Pelosi within this election year.
Yeah, I also think they need to be, Republicans do need to be careful about getting what they wish for, because it would actually present an opportunity for more moderate and conservative Democrats to then publicly go on record not supporting Nancy Pelosi for speaker, and then they can go back home and run on that. And so I think the Connor Lambs of the world, who just recently defeated Republicans to win a special election to come to the House of Representatives, who said he would not support Nancy Pelosi for speaker, would welcome a vote on opposing Nancy Pelosi for speaker, and then go back home to campaign on it and defeat Keith Ruffus, whose district he'll be running in next time around, and be able to actually campaign on that back in Pennsylvania. So it's kind of a mixed bag. I think the overall lesson here, though, about why people are questioning Paul Ryan staying in power is that ability to not really have an implied threat on anybody is really sort of weakening Paul Ryan. When he announced his retirement, he referenced that Senator Reid also announced his retirement and stayed in power, but the Senate's a very different animal. Leading the Senate is more about building consensus on sort of a pack of people and senators going to do what they're going to do. The House, people have a lot less individual freedom. They have a lot less ability to cause trouble as an individual. And so I don't think that the power dynamics are quite the same in the leadership role. So when Paul Ryan said that Senator Reid was the perfect example of someone announcing their retirement and staying power. I think it's different on how Senator Reid was actually using that power in the Senate and governing his caucus versus the way things work in the House.
Well, and I think Harry Reid also had much more support from President Obama than Speaker Ryan has with President Trump. It's no secret that they don't see eye to eye and that this has been a difficult relationship over the past almost 2 years now. And President Trump would probably like to see Representative McCarthy in that speaker spot more so than Paul Ryan. They are very similar. They don't have the personality differences that Paul Ryan and President Trump do. So I think that's also something that's important to remember here. As a member of the administration, Mick Mulvaney, like you mentioned earlier, is said to have been pressuring and trying to kind of stir the pot on this and get McCarthy into that seat sooner rather than later. It's also important to know that Mick Mulvaney's boss, President Trump, would also like to see that happen.
We're just about out of time for this week's Healthcare Happy Hour. As we head into the Memorial Day weekend, what are we toasting to?
This week, we are toasting to those that passed in active military service to our country. As we head into our Memorial Day weekend and enjoy our time outside with family and friends, we'll remember those who served our country.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.